This audio recording of Eric McBay, on the subject of cultures of resistance, was recorded on May 11th in Kingston, Ontario. McBay is the co-author of Deep Green Resistance.
The big question, of course, is how do we kind of build and maintain those communities of resistance? And that's obviously not something I'm going to answer in 20 minutes. It's something we have to figure out in our own communities. And especially networks of communities. But I have some ideas and some stories to help us get started. So first of all, I think it's a lot easier to build if you have some kind of cultural resistance to start with. And if you don't have a firm one, then I think that you have to look for whatever kind of kernel or historical remnant of resistance or defiance that you have available. And Ireland is a really good example of how this was kind of built over time. So in Ireland, there's something called the Gaelic Athletic Association that was founded in the late 1800s. And they were an organization that promoted Gaelic sport. So, soccer was one of them, and especially a sport called hurling, which is kind of complicated and I don't really understand, but it's 3,000 years old and it's pretty popular in Ireland. And so they were founded, about 30 or 40 years before the kind of Easter Rising and the IRA movement that won Ireland's independence. And according to one historian, what they produced was a generation of young people with, quote, a sense of national identity, an extreme nationalist ethos, and a hostility toward state institutions, government, and the forces of law and order. And so they kind of used this broader cultural, organization and this cultural feature to help direct people toward resistance, even though it wasn't an explicitly political organization. It was something that developed their self-confidence, their pride in their culture, and their organizational skills. And, we can see the same thing more than 100 years later in Egypt, apparently in the kind of uprising there this spring. One of the big organizational factors was soccer clubs, because you had these people who were well-organized, and they were used to going out and kind of being hooligans in the street, and they weren't afraid of, going toe-to-toe with the police or the military. And so they became one of the main organizational backbones of that kind of uprising. And I think it's really interesting how that, can happen over time. I'm not sure exactly what the equivalent is here. Maybe it's going to be roller derby.
Yes.
So having that kind of cultural basis is crucial. And I think we can see, the United States is a country that has a much stronger history of many kinds of resistance than Canada does in the white kind of European culture. I think it's really significant that one of the only large kind of underground networks in Canadian history, the FLQ, emerged in French-speaking Quebec, where there's already that kind of distinct culture and distinct cultural pride. And so if we want to build, resistance communities, then we also have to think about inclusion, exclusion, and something called the iron law of involution. So we can learn a lot by looking at historical movements from going back centuries that have set up their own kind of cultures separate, whether communes or, exclusive resistance communities or many different kinds of cultures. You can actually look at, there's often a direct line. So you can look at psychedelic pictures from the 60s with, rainbow colors and the peace signs. And you can see almost identical paintings that were painted in Germany 100 years earlier. So these cultures really get passed on. And we can learn a lot just by seeing what made them succeed or fail, say, 100 years ago. And so there have been these reviews of different kind of communes and resistance communities and what made them successful in the 19th century. And the most successful communes, according to one survey by Rosa Beth Moss Cantor, were those that discouraged relationships outside of the group through geological isolation, self-sufficiency, special kind of dress and language. They tended not to recognize, traditional kind of patriotic holidays. They may not have read any outside newspapers. They tended to have a lot of collective activities that formed strong group identities, like eating together, singing, praying, all of these sorts of things. And I think it's really interesting and informative, but of course, that's a different situation than ours is. We can learn from that, But the point for us is not withdrawal, because that's not going to work. You know, there's nowhere left on the planet to withdraw to at this point. So if we really want, we actually have to change society. We have to engage with society. And that's where it becomes tricky, of course, because, you know, if we are too isolated, then we become marginal and ineffective. If we're too kind of closed off. But if we're too open, then the groups become flooded with people who, you know, don't really understand the fundamentals at play, or who are really invested in kind of the status quo or liberalism or these other, you know, approaches that tend to make resistance groups more ineffective. So I find there's a really interesting analysis that comes out of the work of Jane Mansbridge, who writes about the history of feminism and has written about it since the 1970s. And she discusses this idea of the iron law of involution. So she argues, if social movements can't reward their members materially, and if the activists must find their rewards in ideology and solidarity, then we might expect such movements to follow an iron law of involution, by which every social movement tends to splinter into sects unless it wins quickly, in which she says that it turns into a collection of institutions. And she uses the example of socialism in the United States and says that it kind of split along those lines, that the really inclusive ones became, you know, the labor movement and institution of unions, and the inclusive ones became the labor movement, and the exclusive ones basically became various communist sects who all hated each other's guts and wouldn't even talk to each other and couldn't really get along or speak to people who weren't in their own group. And I think that that's a feature of something I would call a culture of defeat, that when you have a culture that goes on for a long time without, you know, making progress or winning victories, or even moving backward, then it tends to develop those kind of social features that you see maybe an emphasis on personal purity, that people, you know, if you can't beat those in power, then you can have, like, you know, a distinctive diet or clothing or that sort of thing that will kind of substitute for that. Of course, diet and all of those things are important for a separate cultural identity, you know, in many examples, but I also think that they can become a focus, like, say, consumerism, that, okay, I'll buy this hemp shirt and then that'll be, like, my environmentalist thing, rather than focusing on making material changes in power. I think another factor that shows up often is this horizontal hostility, whereas you can't actually fight up the hierarchy and fight those in power, then you start fighting other people who are, you know, basically on the same side and basically agree with you about things, but they're a lot more accessible. So it's a lot easier to kind of take out your frustrations and anger on people you basically agree with than with those you can't really access. And then, of course, there's the kind of psychological factors that people, because of those, become more, they feel more lonely and isolated, and they, because they don't know how to, you know, take effective action, they tend to turn towards symbolic action, whether it be, you know, letter writing or, you know, petition signing and that sort of thing, sign waving. Of course, I think that symbolic action can look very militant as well. I mean, you can have, you know, smashing something. You can smash a window, and that can be a symbolic action, even though it's a militant kind of aggressive action. And so the psychological results of this kind of culture of defeat are, you know, loneliness, apathy, depression, learned helplessness, and the features that I think have become pretty pervasive in general on the left, both radical and liberal, over recent decades. And I think that if we want to win, then one of our jobs is to overcome this psychology, to overcome this culture of defeat. And one of the ways to do that is by actually fighting and by making progress. You know, a culture of resistance or communities of resistance are always viewed as a threat by those in power. As in the film, one of the first things that those in power have done historically is, you know, try to kind of crush them and repress them with, you know, arms or by force, but that's not always very effective because it tends to win sympathy when you're shooting people in the streets. And so one of the most sophisticated systems that the government has come up with since the 1960s is the COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program. Are people generally pretty familiar with that kind of policy, you know, a secret program that the FBI used to kind of try to divide communities, resistance communities, to send, you know, fake letters between people to create arguments, to badger the people, you know, to claim that certain people were snitches, this sort of thing, and to generally produce the same kind of psychology that you would see in a culture of defeat, to produce a sense of isolation and paranoia. And of course, officially COINTELPRO was ended, but obviously it's still continued. And there's been a lot of things in the news about, you know, the Koch brothers recently funding, you know, in Wisconsin, the kind of attack on unions, and funding economics departments in universities to so that they can choose who gets hired and this sort of thing. And a lot of the same general approaches that COINTELPRO used all along. You know, that the funding cuts are getting bad when they have to privatize COINTELPRO. So we can deal with all that sort of thing through security culture and through smart organizing and various other things that are kind of part of another discussion. But I actually think that the most immediate obstacles to building communities of resistance now are actually not from the right wing, they're from the left wing. I think that the left wing, the liberal left in particular, is unwilling to fight in general, and it wants to condemn those who fight. It's generally characterized by a lack of self-awareness and a lack of self-criticism, partly because of this culture of defeat. It's, you know, if you can't accomplish anything, or if you feel like you're not accomplishing anything, then it's a lot easier not to think about why that is, not to kind of delve into strategy. And worse, especially if you're, you know, kind of comfortable and middle class, then that kind of strategic thinking might lead you down a road that would risk your privilege and risk your comfort. I wanted to quote, you know, I think that in that way liberalism has become a real barrier to action. And I wanted to quote someone named Thomas Lindsay, who works with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. They go around helping different communities to kind of organize to fight against things like, you know, water bottling plants and toxic waste dumps and this sort of thing. And he says, the hardest places to work are the liberal progressive communities, because they think we have a democracy and are intent on working within the existing structure to try to find a remedy rather than tossing it and working from scratch. But in the liberal progressive bastion of Berkeley, he compares a kind of conservative place where they were just like, okay, well, let's take to the streets, with Berkeley, where they were passing non-binding resolutions, certainly they were passing resolutions, urging Congress to do something about it. And he says, you know, that they're just basically asking Congress and wasting all their time. And I think that Chris Hedges, can you pass the water over here? Chris Hedges wrote a really interesting book called The Death of the Liberal Class. And he defines the liberal class as that kind of traditional part of society that includes part of the press, you know, labor unions, universities, thanks, liberal churches, that moves for this kind of incremental social reform. And he argues that over the last, you know, say 30 years, that in an effort to become more acceptable to those in power, that it's gotten rid of all of the radicals from its ranks, that it's purged people who believe in radical action or radical thought. And he argues, quote, the purging and silencing of independent and radical thinkers has robbed the liberal class of its vitality. The liberal class has cut itself off from the roots of creative and bold thought, from those forces and thinkers who could have prevented the liberal class from merging completely with the power elite. And he basically argues that the liberal class is done, it's dead, and that any kind of reforms that it's made in the past, say through civil rights, it's never going to make again because it's merged itself with the power elite and with the corporate class, and that they're never going to risk their comfort in order to do the kinds of things that, you know, historically that social movements have done in North America. And so what do we do about this? Well, I think one of the things that irks me most about liberals, aside from their kind of cheerful collaboration with corporatocracy and the destruction of the biosphere, is their appropriation of radical victories. So So, you know, women's suffrage, the eight-hour day, the end of segregation, independence in countries around the world, from Eastern Europe to South Africa, were won by radical communities using radical tactics. And as is discussed in the film very conveniently, those victories have been appropriated by liberals. And the reality of those struggles has been sanitized to privilege these very narrow kinds of tactics that they feel really good about and that feel non-threatening, but in actuality were only a part of a larger and diverse struggle that wouldn't have succeeded without, you know, more radical actions. So one of the things that I think we have to do if we want to shake off that culture of defeat is to reclaim and to celebrate our history as radicals. It's a cultural tradition that we should be proud of and one that's worth passing on. And I also think that in many radical communities that there's been maybe a tendency towards too much of the kind of exclusion side of the inclusion-exclusion balance. Because the left has so fully accepted things like capitalism and has generally accepted the logic of the dominant culture, it is often very difficult to have frank conversations with people who, you know, generally want to have equitable societies and to have a habitable planet and this sort of thing, but who maybe haven't thought through fully the tactics needed to get there and the tactics that have been used historically to make progress. It's often really hard to, I'll speak for myself, that it's really frustrating to have these conversations. And you feel sometimes like, you know, you're banging your head against your wall, having a conversation with someone who's just kind of swallowed the liberal line. And it's really tempting to just say, well, screw it, I'm not even going to bother. And I think for the people who are really at the top, like the people who are running, you know, Greenpeace and who are running these larger liberal organizations, that's true. You're not going to convince them of anything. They're very comfortable and they're, you know, getting a lot out of their situation. But I also think that there are a lot of people on the fringe who kind of accept those arguments because they've never really been faced with a counter-argument. And, you know, they are constantly kind of bombarded with the propaganda of the status quo. And the liberal end of the mainstream media just repeats the same kind of basic arguments over and over, or what's left of the liberal mainstream media at this point. So I think that we have to get uncomfortable sometimes and have these conversations and try to recruit people who are on the edge and who are questioning into more radical communities. You know, I think there was it must have been earlier this year, there was an event where John Baer, the government minister, came to town over at the grad club. It was something else. But he gave a talk, and there was kind of a fundraiser. And a lot of people from the Prison Farm campaign in particular came out to kind of picket this. Mm-hmm. And some people who were present wanted to block cars, which was something that had been done, you know, many other times in the Prison Farm campaign and many times in you know, recent decades when Tories have come to Kingston. And there is a definite argument in the kind of line between people who wanted to block cars and people who said, oh my God, you can't block cars. I mean, inconveniencing people, that's like violence, more or less. And so this is the kind of, you know, frustrating situation where you're like, well, it's useless to work with someone who is not willing to, like, slow down the car of someone who literally wants to, you know, imprison thousands of people in this town for essentially being poor. But a lot of people came up to me after that who had kind of, like, been on the fringe of the crowd, and they're like, yeah, I'm sorry I didn't get in there. I was kind of surprised. I felt a little awkward. But, you know, next time I'll be right there. And I think that's how it is when this kind of the liberal culture is so pervasive that there's people don't really encounter the radical alternative, that they have to be exposed a few times before they kind of feel like, oh, okay, well, maybe that's not totally crazy. And that's one of our jobs. It's like in the Millikan experiment or the Milgram experiment. is to come out and say, you know, don't stop electrocuting that person, stop electrocuting that person, until they actually start to pay attention. And I think in general, you know, one way that we can do that is by kind of identifying ourselves as radicals or as a radical bloc. Because, you know, if there were 10 or 20 people who had showed up to that as kind of an organized group who said, we're going to block the cars, then there wouldn't have been an argument. Because, you know, everyone there thought, okay, there's this mob, and the people who are on the liberal side think, well, of course, everyone here is a liberal. And if they don't, you know, follow the rules, it's because they are, like, violent or they're not thinking about it. So I think that it's important for radical communities to have that presence and to say, you know, we're actually a part of this culture, and these victories in history are victories of radicals, not of liberalism alone. And so I think that that's, you know, part of this kind of celebration. And this is a really good venue and a really good, you know, event to serve as an example for that. There's celebrations, you know, all over the walls. I appreciate there's a poster over there that says, remember and celebrate our victories, or something like that. So I think that, you know, in the same way that communities in occupied Europe or many other occupied places did, we have to kind of build up that cultural basis. And that takes a long time, potentially, but it's also a lot of fun to have, you know, community events and to come out to films and to get to know people. And so I think that that's something that it's really important for us to undertake. And I also think, you know, that radical communities are partly built through those cultural activities, but they're also built through action. And that action is kind of the basis of resistance. And so, you know, if the culture of defeat is defined by isolation, by horizontal hostility, and by ineffective symbolic action, then a culture of resistance is based on community and solidarity and effective direct action, and especially on networked direct action. I think it's really significant that last year, when a number of kind of arrests and conspiracy charges were made, a number of community activists around Ontario, they were made of people who were trying to network with other communities and who were trying to build a broader campaign. And it's obvious that the state finds that extremely threatening. So that's probably one of the things that we should be trying really hard to do. I understand that there are a bunch of people from Belleville here tonight, so that's exciting. And so, yeah, people will join a community of resistance, or will join when it's not a community of defeat. As so many of these, you know, protest events feel so defeatist and doomed. People will join when it feels like we can win, when there's something new and exciting. So if we want to, you know, to win, then we have to build a movement that looks like it can win, and that people